Tens of thousands of volunteers turned out today at service projects across the region. I'm Brad Linder, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller's off this evening. This Martin Luther King Jr. Day of Service is marking its 21st year. Organizers say it's more than breaking a one-day record. It's becoming a way of life on King Day in Philadelphia. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports.
More than 140,000 volunteers are serving today in some 1,800 projects throughout our region. 5,000 volunteers descended on the headquarters at Girard College to put on a kids' carnival, workshops, discussions, trainings, as well as a health and fitness fair. For the fifth year, there's a jobs and opportunity fair with 26 employers. Volunteer Ayalyanda Laia was involved in teaching children to play chess and Scrabble. She says Dr. King would have been pleased to see people from many different backgrounds teaming up together.
This is activity, and it's kind of in an enclosed, you know, forum. But I think this is really what he envisioned for the world, for people.
The Day of Service has grown so big by recruiting groups to participate. Carol Harvey and her sorority turned out in big numbers to help out. She says one day of harmony is not enough.
I think if each of us stepped up and lived this, as opposed to just celebrating it one day of the year, we say Martin Luther King Day, 365 days of the year.
Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney says the Day of Service is a good time for reflection.
A lot of times we get caught up in our world, we become selfish and self-centered, and Dr. King's legacy, and along with events like this, remind us that we are our brother's keeper and sister's keeper, and we need to help each other every day in life. No one's on their own.
As a former Peace Corps volunteer, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf says he understands the value of service.
We really need to give back to our communities to do what we can every day, not just on one day of the year, to make our communities better.
The event has broken volunteer records every year for 21 straight years since being established by Todd Bernstein and former U.S. Senator Harris Wofford. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Pastors, elected officials, and activists took the stage inside Bright Hope Baptist Church today for an annual program honoring Martin Luther King Jr. The service's keynote speaker was Jonathan Jackson, national spokesperson for the Rainbow Push Coalition and son of civil rights leader Jesse Jackson. The younger Jackson said, "We can't forget that King wanted people to serve others all year round, not just on one day."
Go clean out your closet. Right. Go wash your bathroom. Go clean out a busted down, broken, vacant lot. Bring somebody some groceries. Seriously. And it's up to us to make sure that the message does not get watered down.
As part of that message, speakers called on the crowd to get out and vote and help others to do the same. Rodney Muhammad is president of the Philadelphia chapter of the NAACP, which co-hosted the event.
We're not coming out to vote in the numbers that we should be coming out to vote. No one's stopping us now except ourselves.
The push for social justice continued at Philadelphia International Airport, where an interfaith group continued to push for union representation and a $12 minimum wage for airport subcontractors. That group, Power, is also holding a meeting this evening to pray for systematic change with Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney. Just before Christmas, former Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter declared veteran homelessness had been effectively ended in the city. Days later, the Department of Veterans Affairs quietly ended a $1.5 million partnership that supported formerly homeless vets. WHYY's Ryan Briggs reports.
1,390 veterans are now in permanent housing, and most of those persons were chronically homeless, having been homeless for a year or more.
Shortly after former Mayor Michael Nutter gave that speech, Vietnam veteran Gary Kaur learned that he would be saying goodbye to his caseworkers at the nonprofit Pathways to Housing.
This is very, chaotic for me because it's like losing my family.
3 years ago, Kaur was homeless and struggling with substance abuse. Then the VA referred him and many of its most difficult cases to Pathways for more intensive care. Caseworkers there helped chronically homeless vets find housing and transition to life off the streets, relearning basic life skills like grocery shopping or managing personal finances. But CORE says the program is about more than just that.
They've taught me and showed me that, you know, you're not alone. And that was the most important thing, because I had been alone so long that they let me know you do have somebody that cares.
Since 2012, the group has placed more than 400 homeless veterans, becoming a national model. But a few days before Christmas, Pathways was notified that its remaining 124 clients would be transferred back to the VA Medical Center. A spokesperson for the VA says the agency had determined it could now provide homeless support internally and at a lower cost. But Samantha Leader, a caseworker at Pathways, worries the VA won't provide the same level of care that helped her clients succeed.
So we have about 3 to 4 case managers on each team. We have a nurse, a certified peer specialist, a team leader, assistant team leader, and a program assistant. Whereas at the VA and maybe other service agencies, you're assigned one caseworker.
A National Institutes of Health study found that the average VA social worker was assigned between 25 and 35 homeless clients. At Pathways, it's 10. Gary Core will keep his apartment, but starting in April, he will once again receive support services at the VA. He says he feels like he's starting over.
It's devastating for that kind of happiness to just be snatched from you after being given to you for so long, you know, and then just be taken.
For WHYY, I'm Ryan Briggs.
In today's headlines, the families of two Pennsylvania men who are among a dozen Marines missing after two helicopters crashed off of Hawaii say they're hoping the effort will be successful. Search efforts have gone on around the clock since the Coast Guard was notified late Thursday of the helicopters, each carrying 6 Marines that went down off Oahu's North Shore. Atlantic City residents, clergy, and elected officials gathered in a black church today to oppose a state takeover of the Seaside Gambling Resort and defend the community's right to govern itself. New Jersey Senate President Steve Sweeney has introduced a bill that would give the state vast power over Atlantic City, including the right to make the most major decisions and sell city assets. But speakers at St. James AME Church called for public hearings on the bill and started a petition against it. Officials say a box truck and a light rail train collided in downtown Jersey City this morning, leaving 6 train passengers injured. New Jersey Transit says the collision occurred just before 7 o'clock this morning. The agency says the train hit the back of the truck after the truck moved on to the southbound tracks when the train had the right of way. There were 38 people aboard the train at the time. 6 of them were treated for minor injuries. The name of the box truck driver was not released. The accident caused minor travel delays in the area while the accident was under investigation. The Federal Small Business Administration is still processing low-interest loans for Superstorm Sandy, which hit in 2012. The agency has reopened the disaster loan filing period for businesses and residents and has already approved more than $8.5 million for the 242 businesses and residents in affected areas. Checking the WHYY forecast, clear skies tonight with a low around 17 degrees. Tomorrow, sunny with a high around 30. Tomorrow night, mostly clear with a low around 22 degrees. Wednesday, mostly sunny with a high near 38. And Thursday, more sunshine with a high close to 40 degrees. It's 21 degrees in Wilmington, Delaware, and 23 degrees in Center City at 6:14. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight. Still ahead.
So these are eels? This looks like perch.
So this is a freezer full of contaminated fish?
From the Passaic River, yep.
How New Jersey is attempting to dissuade residents from eating the polluted spoils of their weekend fishing trips. That's coming up as Newsworks Tonight continues.
Financial news changes by the very minute. Domestic and global markets are crazy.
China's not about to move away from buying U.S. treasuries.
The European Central Bank wading into the Spanish and Italian government bond market today.
The whole debt ceiling debate made us look dysfunctional. We all know that.
That's okay, though, because we're here. Marketplace. It's the business show for the rest of us. It's from APM, American Public Media.
Marketplace follows Newsworks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Cabrini College is proud to support WHYY, now offering part-time doctoral degrees in organizational development and educational leadership. Cabrini can help you earn a PhD or EdD in 3 years without giving up your life. Their faculty and small classes help to expand your knowledge and professional network while giving you the tools to advance your career. More information on Cabrini's professional doctoral programs is available at cabrini.edu/doc.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Brad Linder, in for Dave Heller. The fish in much of New Jersey's waterways are too contaminated to eat. For decades, industries that line the state's rivers dump toxic waste into the water, including dioxin from Agent Orange. Despite the serious health risks, some residents still eat from contaminated waters. It's free food. As part of our ongoing series, Dirty Little Secrets, New Jersey Public Radio's Sarah Gonzalez reports some of the companies responsible for the pollution have come up with their own approach for protecting human health.
Eating anything from the lower Passaic River can cause cancer, liver damage, birth defects, and reproductive issues. But Oswaldo Abad does it all the time. Standing on the bank where the Passaic River meets the Newark Bay, he's reeling in a small bluefish and part of a grocery bag.
One piece plastic and one fish.
One piece of plastic and one fish? He already has a bucket full of what he calls his poor contaminated fish. Pobrecitos, he says.
Five? Yes, five.
Are you going to eat it?
Yeah, that's good.
Abad is from Ecuador. He loves fishing. He says he forgets about his debts out here. He's hilarious. And he switches between English and Spanish because his English is only good after a few drinks.
Tengo que emborracharme para hablar.
Children, pregnant women, women who might one day want to be pregnant, they're not supposed to eat any fish from pretty much any body of water near New Jersey. Men can. According to the state, Abad can eat one catfish per year from the Newark Bay or four striped bass a year. From the Hudson River, he can eat one eel per year or seven blue crab a week. But you have to throw out the liquid the crab is cooked in because that liquid is toxic. Abad has been eating way more than what is considered safe for years.
Lo lavo, lo salo.
He washes them, salts them.
Pongo ajo, los frío.
Garlic, fry it.
Lo hago sopa, en caldo.
Caldo?
Sí.
Caldo de crab?
Sopa.
Crab soup?
No, no, de crab.
Catfish soup? Sounds good. Entonces, you eat more than one a month?
Yeah.
And you don't get scared?
No.
The Passaic River is one of the most contaminated bodies of water in the country. More than 100 companies are potentially responsible for dumping toxic waste in it for decades before that was outlawed. The EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, wants the polluters to clean it up. In the meantime, some of the polluters have formed a group. They call themselves the Cooperating Parties. And in an effort to reduce the health risks to some of the most vulnerable in the community, they're funding a fish exchange program, which brought me to a greenhouse in Newark.
Oh my gosh!
300 tilapia rushed toward me, gray and pinkish fish all swimming up against a little window in their tub. They're excited to see me. Amy Rowe says so. She's an environmental chemist at Rutgers University who oversees the fish farm for the polluters.
They want to interact with people because they know that we give the food.
They know?
Yeah. Which is why they're so excited to see everybody.
Every Saturday when it's warm out, residents can bring in their contaminated catch from the Passaic.
Eels, crabs, carp, whitefish.
And swap it for clean, healthy tilapia, pound for pound. But these tilapia that are so excited to see me, they aren't big enough to swap.
No, unfortunately, these weren't quite ready for harvest size, and so we actually bought tilapia fillets from Costco. Yeah.
Like frozen bags of tilapia?
Okay. Yep, frozen packages.
The Cooperating Parties, the polluters, have spent more than $1 million funding the greenhouse and the fish swap. They've prevented 170 contaminated fish from being eaten, which are now sitting in a freezer in Newark.
So these are eels. This looks like perch.
So this is a freezer full of contaminated fish?
From the Passaic River, yep. Oh, there's some more eels.
And Amy Rowe isn't sure what to do with them.
They could just go to a landfill. They could be buried somewhere in New Mexico. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to get it out of Newark.
Legally, she can just throw them in the trash where they'll end up being burned. But environmental justice advocates like Molly Greenberg with the Ironbound Community Corporation warned contaminated fish better not end up in their incinerator.
You breathe in what comes out of the smokestack. If it's toxic when you eat it, it's toxic when you breathe it. The question that was posed to me, which is, what would you do with it? And our response is, we wouldn't start a project where we can't answer that.
Advocates think the whole fish exchange is a distraction tactic, a PR move to avoid cleaning up the Passaic. But Walter Mugden with the EPA says the fish swap is not a solution.
It's not something we've proposed, nor is it something that we've endorsed. It's certainly no substitute for cleaning up the river and getting the fish to be clean in the first place.
The EPA wants the polluters to replace 2 feet of toxic mud from the river bottom with clean rocks, sand, and gravel. It's a $1.7 billion cleanup. It's one of the largest proposed sediment removals in the history of the EPA's Superfund program. The polluters think that's excessive. They want to fund a cheaper, smaller cleanup. But Mugden says they don't get a say.
We make the decision. That's not something that we negotiate.
A spokesperson for the polluters told WNYC that the EPA's proposal is, quote, destined for years of conflict and litigation. Meanwhile, it could be decades before the fish are safe to eat. And families who rely on food from the state's contaminated waters, they're not always going to wait a week to take their catch to a fish swap. That's Walter Anchecta. He's from Honduras, and he's cutting up a small snapper he caught to use as bait for a bigger fish. Anchecta is out here with his wife and kids, the population that isn't supposed to eat anything from the water. What they catch will be their dinner. I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
For an illustrated history of the fish exchange program by WNYC's data news team, go to WNYC.org. The New Horizons spacecraft's flyover by Pluto is yielding data that's warming the hearts and minds of astronomers. That's the subject of this week's discussion between Newsworks Tonight host Dave Heller and Franklin Institute chief astronomer Derek Pitts.
Derek, warm and Pluto in the same sentence?
Yeah, that's really almost oxymoronic. But the New Horizons spacecraft, which took 9 years to get to Pluto, flew by last August, but in the few hours that it spent in close proximity to Pluto, it gathered a tremendous amount of data that's being slowly fed back to Earth. Now, we see features that look like convection cells. These are features that we find on hot objects, hot gaseous objects typically, that show the transfer of heat from the interior up to the surface of the medium. Okay, in this case, the medium is a frozen nitrogen ice mixture that seems to make up the surface of this portion of Pluto, and we can see evidence that there's some sort of internal heat source that creates these convection cell kinds of things. But we're stunned to even see that there's any kind of evidence of any sort of internal heat source at Pluto.
Might there be more information coming in about this?
Oh, I think we're going to see plenty more information about this particular phenomenon, but we will find out all sorts of other things about the planet's surface. I mean, we're talking about right now a very small portion of the planet's surface that appears to be bright in color, has a particular shape. This is that heart-shaped region of the planet that's known as Sputnik Planum. As we look around the rest of the surface, we find other remarkable features that indicate processes going on that we were, before this time, completely unaware of. I think all the data that comes back to us is going to help us to think of Pluto as being, as I think of it anyway, the newest planet of the solar system.
Now, lest we get feedback for listeners wondering why Dr. Pitts is referring to Pluto as a planet, do you want to modify that descriptive?
Well, I could. When we describe Pluto as a dwarf planet, we're using a term that describes a group of objects that don't display all of the characteristics that the International Astronomical Union is using to identify planets. However, we know that that definition is in flux. So if we describe it also as the largest of the Kuiper belt objects, that at least puts it in a physical realm where it certainly does dominate all of these other objects that are out beyond Neptune's orbit. And so maybe that's more accurate. But we still have quite a bit of discovery to do to find out exactly which of these monikers is going to be the right one, or if there's need for another one altogether.
Step outside this week under clear, dark, albeit cold skies this week. what planets and perhaps dwarf planets are available to be seen.
Yes, if only the dwarf planets could be seen. They're so far out. But there are plenty of other planets to be seen. You know, the pre-dawn sky has absolutely been blowing away every other kind of observing time we've been able to identify for at least a year. The pre-dawn sky right now is showing us the brightest planets of the entire solar system. Venus down close to the eastern horizon at 6:30 in the morning, followed a little higher in the sky by Saturn, a little higher still is Mars, and still higher around toward the south is Jupiter. And as the weeks go on, we begin to see the separation between Venus and Saturn growing as the Earth makes its way around the Sun, and also as Venus makes its way around the Sun. And as we continue on later in the month, we'll see the moon start to enter the picture yet again, and it'll play among the planets as we move into February. So the pre-dawn sky is perfect, perfect for getting a good look at most of the planets of our solar system in one fell swoop.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, sign up without a space, ways incorporated.
Finally, after more than a decade with the same head coach, the Eagles now have their third one in just over 3 years. The team officially announced today that former Eagles quarterback Doug Peterson will take over for the much-hyped but ultimately lackluster Chip Kelly, who was fired toward the end of the season. The 47-year-old Peterson spent 3 seasons as offensive coordinator under Chiefs head coach Andy Reid, who was head coach of the Eagles for 13 seasons. In a statement, Eagles owner Jeff Lurie called Peterson a strategic thinker, a compelling leader and communicator, and someone who truly knows how to get the best out of his players. Peterson will be in town tomorrow for a press conference. We wonder how long the honeymoon will last. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. For now, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is still running for president in the crowded GOP field. Christie scribe Matt Katch joins us tomorrow evening to discuss his new book, American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brad Linder for NewsWorks Tonight.
From Major Tom to Aladdin Sane, Ziggy Stardust to the Thin White Duke, David Bowie continued to reinvent his persona and his art until the very end.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh.
We'll look back at the remarkable life and career of David Bowie this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center, part of Temple Health, supports WHYY and Cervical Cancer Awareness Month. Gynecologic oncologists at Fox Chase Cancer Center perform complex surgeries for patients with cervical cancer. Fox Chase doctors are also actively involved in developing new therapies for treating cervical cancer. Through clinical trials, they are able to offer patients access to promising treatments and experimental therapies that may not be available elsewhere. Now offering next-day business appointments. Learn more at foxchase.org.
If I were a rich man,
Fiddler on the Roof is back on Broadway in a new revival. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview from our archive with the show's songwriters, Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock. And we'll hear a song or two that was written for the show but never used. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM.
Idle diddle 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 man.